And the beginning of these lectures is going to be about measurements on quantum fields and the notion of particle detectors. So we're going to do a little bit of a review, a very basic. I'll try not to wave my hands too much, even though I will probably start with a little bit of hand waving. But the idea here is to understand what people actually, so what are the difficulties of measurements on quantum fields? What people do on the field of quantum optics, what models do they use? And then we're going to go from first principles derivation of a model of particle detector and the light-matter interaction. And we're going to compare the two models, the models that people use in quantum optics usually, and the models coming from first principles to see what the differences are. And when they are good descriptions and when they're not. And that's a little bit of the beginning of our understanding of how actually we can actually get information from quantum fields. All right, so measuring quantum fields. So I mentioned in the previous lecture that the usual approach that people do in quantum mechanics, as in like the measurement problem they do, well, let's just sweep it under the carpet and postulate projective measurements. That is not quite satisfactory if applied naively in quantum fields. Now, very hand-wavy example, but I think illustrates a little bit part of the problem. Say that I have a quantum field living in a flat space-time background. And imagine that I have, I don't know, two operators of magic detectors that can do projective measurements. So we have, say I have a space-like slice where a localized observer, Alice, is able to access the field and make a projective measurement of the field on a region A. Okay? And then I have another observer. Let me just draw a light cone here of Alice's measurement. So let's say that I have another observer here, Bob, that can carry out a projective measurement on a localized region of spacetime, B. Now, of course, the projection B, the measurement done in B, should not be able to get any information about A. And indeed, if you actually do just a naive, again, to do a projective measurement, there are subtleties that are involved, as in like, well, I do my projective measurement on a time slice. So I have at some time, I activate my detector and do a projective measurement. So the projection on A, of course, modifies only a localized observable on the field, and the action of that measurement propagates causally, of course, because this is a quantum field, and the free dynamics of the quantum field guarantees causal propagation. Now, if we get another observer that carries a projective measurement B on a region that is space-like separated from the region A, then B will not find any information about A. Now, the problem comes if we allow for localized projective measurements everywhere, because we can think of an observer C that we assume is able to do a projective measurement on a field on a localized region C, and then C can access information about A because it's causally connected. Part of the region it's measuring is causally connected with A, but also C can influence B. And through the influence on B, B can know now about A because the modification of C and the modification of B, sorry, the modification made on C is not independent from the modification made on A. This is the kind of problem of superluminal signaling that you would get if you just naively apply a projective measurement on a field. This is just to illustrate, this is one of the few times, very few, I hope, that I have to wave my hands a little bit. But this is just to give an idea why making projections, naive projections on a quantum field, say that at a given time I make a projective measurement, is not a satisfactory description for a measurement on a quantum field. You get problems of causal signaling. Now, people look at this rigorously. There are several papers looking at the problem of projective measurements on quantum fields. There are ways to do them that are okay with causality, but then again, all of them have shortcomings that make them very unrealistic models of measuring quantum fields. Projective measurements are bad in general. I mean, even in regular quantum mechanics, projective measurements are not a great thing because projective measurements set out a distinction between detectors and systems.
as in like systems are quantum, and my detectors are somehow not quantum. They don't couple through Hamiltonians. Remember, a projector is a self-adjoint operator, but it's not unitary in general. Therefore, it cannot be generated by a Hamiltonian of interaction between a detector and a field. Projective measurements are kind of outside of quantum mechanics in the sense that they treat detectors at a different level than systems. Okay? Questions about this? All right. So how do we approach measuring quantum fields? Now, in fact, if we actually ask the experts on measuring quantum fields, I don't know, if you go to CERN or somewhere like that, where they actually measure quantum fields, or you go to someone with eyes that actually measure quantum fields, if you ask all of them, they will probably tell you, yeah, actually, we don't do, I don't know what that is, carrying out measurements on quantum fields as a projection. What I do is I have another system, say a CCD, say, I don't know, a retina. I have a quantum system that couples to the field. And that quantum system at the couples at the atomic level with the field, and that extracts information from the field. The information is in the field, and then goes to a detector that couples to the field, all right? So that way of measuring fields is the way of measuring fields. We do not measure fields directly. We use always particle detectors. Does anyone disagree with that statement? OK, I like debate. So if you disagree with that statement, yeah.
But the particle detectors measure the field directly.
Yeah, but they're not classical systems. So the point being that it's not the same as doing a projective measurement. OK? We always measure. So the way we access information about fields is not through measuring second quantized systems. It's coupling first quantized systems to them.
But so are you saying that quantum mechanics is classical because the projective measurements are in a sense, classical?
No, I'm not saying it's classical. I'm saying that introducing projective measurement treats detectors and systems differently. It's like detectors are above quantum mechanics. Because somehow detectors are able to do projective measurements which are not generated by Hamiltonians, by self-adjoint operators. All right, so the way we actually detect or measure fields is coupling sort of first quantized systems or systems that are well described without the need of second quantization to the full second quantized quantum field. Okay? That is the way in practice we measure quantum fields. Now, what do people do? In quantum optics. A question. Now, in quantum optics, people use actually models that couple matter, say, I don't know, something like an atom, to a quantum field, say, in quantum optics, usually the electromagnetic field. Now, In quantum optics, what people use most often is something called the James Cummings model. What is that? So let me write it in the simplest and most popular variant, which is, all right, say I have two-level atom, so they conceive some quantum system that has two levels, say excited and ground. And then they consider coupling to a mode of, let me just write like that, the electromagnetic field that they model as a harmonic oscillator. OK? And the coupling, so the two-level atom has an energy gap omega. Difference, let's call that the energy difference between the ground and the excited state. And the way they couple, most often, is like this. This is an interaction Hamiltonian. And that interaction Hamiltonian, what you get is a degree of freedom of the atom coupled to the field in some way
And the way they write it is like this. So let's say I have a sum of, well, they usually have only one mode. So let me just write one mode. So you have a lambda. Then you have something like sigma plus a. And then let me just write in the interaction picture. I would have I omega minus k. Just write small omega plus sigma minus a dagger e 2 minus I omega minus omega. So some coupling strength, and then what are these operators here? So sigma plus, sigma minus are SU2 ladder operators. So basically sigma plus acting on the ground state, it's equal to the excited state. Sigma minus acting on the excited state, it's equal to the ground state. And sigma plus minus squared is zero. So if you act twice, you will annihilate whatever. And if you add one, you excite the ground state with sigma plus, and you excite the excited state with sigma minus. And of course, A and A dagger are the usual annihilation operators following canonical commutation relationships. Now, how good a detector is this, and why? And why is it written like this? Okay, so it's kind of based, I guess, on a very classical intuition, which is, yeah. So I have an energy omega on the field. On the detector. I have energy omega between the levels of the harmonic oscillator that I'm using as a mode of the field. And somehow, I can excite my detector by eating a photon, whatever that means. And I can de-excite my detector by creating a photon. It's kind of reasonable from the classical perspective point of view. So these are, and they say, well, only one mode. Yeah, you can refine this model if you want, adding a sum over different modes and adding even a coupling strength that depends on the mode that you're coupling to. But this is the most common way in which people simply without more complications model the light matter interaction. So we're gonna see if this model has any hope of describing the light matter interaction properly. Any questions about this? This is very simple, and I want questions. I don't want anyone to get lost on the details because you're not familiar with it. Have you ever seen something like this? Okay, I had a question, yeah.
Why is it allowed to couple to a mode that doesn't have the same energy as the energy gap?
That's a good point. So in general, this omega, typically this omega is gonna be very close to big omega, because they would argue, well, I'm coupling only to one mode because there's some sort of resonance, and the interaction with the rest of the modes is negligible. So yeah, typically, this would be very close to this. That's to give a little bit of the tuning freedom.
But it looks like you're maybe like exciting the field and creating a particle with more energy than you put in.
Right? Oh, I love that question, because that question is kind of relying on this intuition of that kind of conserves energy, right? Because the energy is either in the atom or in the field. Yeah, good point. Yeah, in fact, the simplest is like, yeah, they have to be kind of the same, because otherwise seems like I'm violating some sort of energy conservation, because, you know, the atom has an energy omega, then the excites it doesn't put an energy big omega on the field. Yeah, very good question, and we will get to that, actually. If you had some patience, we will get to that, because that's one of the problems of the quantum optics textbook description, yeah. I'm not advocating for this model. In case, spoiler alert, I'm going to argue that this model is definitely not great. Yeah?
Is there a D missing on the scale of
time? A D?
D. On the...
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Thank you. All right. So this model is like ubiquitous. Like, you will find it everywhere to model interaction of something with something that looks like a field. OK? So let's see. What a more realistic model. So let's go back. So in any case, we cannot just postulate it like this. I mean, I guess we can. You are free to postulate. That's one of the freedoms of the physicists, right? But if you want actually to describe something that is a realistic like matter interaction,
you better go back to first principles, or at least if you're a theoretical physicist, you better go back to first principles and try to see where these things should come from. So we're going to go back. How do I? It'd be nice to actually be able to put this up. So let me try. Front, I guess, is the front. Is it visible?
That's nice.
Not from here, it's gonna reflect it. Okay, so. Like matter interaction. From first principles. So when I say first principles, what do I mean? I'm not going to go back to the standard model. That's a question.
Can I just go back to this gamma and omega, with these two omegas not being exactly the same?
Yeah.
Is it too early to start talking about the fact that the energy gap isn't exactly omega because of broadening of lines and these kind of things?
Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah, it's related to uncertainty in energies and also the tuning ability. But anyway, we will get to that when we actually figure out if the model is good and in what ways it's good and under what conditions that model is actually approximating something that's real. Okay? I just wanted you before, I guess the safer way would have been first deduce the model and then compare it with what people do. But I just wanted you to, you know, maybe you have seen this before. I wanted you to be, I don't know, in your minds to have an idea what people do and where they, how do people, some people when they're teaching these things, they kind of build some intuition about it. As in like, yeah, it seems like energy is this classical intuition of atom eats photon, atom emits photon. That's the intuition behind this kind of proposal for a model. All right, so let's say that my detector is, so again, the word first principles means let's try to assume the least possible. Okay, that's what I mean by first principle. So let's say that my detector is an atom. Okay, or in particular, a hydrogen kind of like atom. So I have an electron in an atom, and that electron in an atom, right, is bound to the atom through a Coulomb potential. So it's, let's say I have an atom as a first quantized system, the atomic physics that you all saw in first year undergrad, I guess, or whatever you see that, the hydrogen atom. All right, so I can write a Hamiltonian for an electron in a hydrogen-like atom. All right. So that Hamiltonian would be the way you've always seen it. So I'm going to try to write the vectors and the hats, which means that I will probably forget. Sometimes don't feel any shy to tell me when I forget things. This is the reduced mass of the electron if you want. And this is a Coulomb potential. All right, so this is the way, this is the interaction Hamiltonian, sorry, the Hamiltonian of an electron in an atom that you probably saw back in the day when people were telling you about hydrogen atoms, right? So nothing surprising here. Now, people know the solutions to this, to the student Schrödinger equation that has this H as time evolution generator. People solve that and finds wave functions and orbitals and a lot of structure in there. As you know. Now we can say, okay, the electron can couple to an EM field. And you would say, isn't it already? Because it's in a Coulomb potential. I would say not quite, because this is not really, this is a static field. It's a zero mode of the field, if you want. It's a non-time-dependent potential. So let's say that I have a fully time-dependent quantum field, the electromagnetic field. So say that I want to couple this to an electromagnetic field. So that interaction Hamiltonian. So you know how to, have you ever seen how to do this? I assume yes, because you are taking like very advanced courses. And what we would do is minimal coupling, because that's the way you can couple an electron or a charge to an electromagnetic field, being respectful with the symmetries of space-time. Okay? That's the only way. Well, That's the only way that makes sense, that is respectful with the symmetries of space-time. So this is B minus E A of Px. See, it's a classical field. I haven't quantized the field yet. Square over 2m. Modification of the canonical momentum. All right. Plus the possibly time dependent. Oh, sorry. Scalar potential, plus, of course, the Coulomb potential that we had. OK, that's the Hamiltonian that couples is a vector that couples an electron trapped in a hydrogen atom to, oh, missing an E, to the electromagnetic field. Also, if I write the E here, I should write the E here. Consistency. Questions about this? Very simple stuff so far, no? All right. So now faced with that, you would think, all right, when people were doing at the beginning of quantum optics, what people were doing is like looking at this, because obviously that's where you start from. That's the way electrons couple to the electromagnetic field. And they realize soon of something funny. The thing is like, right, I am free to pick a gauge because I know that electromagnetism is a gauge theory. So people tend to say, okay, let's work in the Coulomb gauge, they said. Why? Because the Coulomb gauge just removes this. That is kind of inconvenient. So let's work in the Coulomb gauge and let's see what happens. So if I don't pick a gauge yet and I expand this, I would get A. I get a term that looks like a lot like the free energy of the electron, or the free energy, the non-coupled energy of the detector. Let's call this H0 if we want. That would be the Hamiltonian of the electron in the absence of an external electromagnetic field, fully time-dependent electromagnetic field. And then we get things like this. Let's see if I don't forget any terms. So we get E over 2m P dot A Px minus A dot P. Overall minus and a plus, right? All right, xp. And then I get also plus e u dx. And I get, finally, a term e square over 2m a square dx. All right. This is just expanding the square in there. Now, people said, right, we have that. Problems that we have. I see some problems. Problem number one. I have an a square. A square is kind of dangerous. Oh, I put a hat on the a. I shouldn't yet. A square is kind of dangerous when I quantize the electromagnetic field because divergences and stuff. So, okay, first note of caution. But they said, no, but then again, I want to describe the light matter interaction. The charge of the electron is small. So maybe I can do perturbative analysis. This is like higher order. Maybe I can neglect first consideration. So let's go. The path of quantum optics. Number one. Let's neglect order E square. So rid of the complication of the A square. Second,
let's work in the Coulomb gauge. That means that A and P commutes, and that U is zero. So things simplify quite a bit. And then you get, you can write this as E over M, P times A.
Why did he commute?
You can compute in the Coulomb gauge because the divergence of A is zero, and this commutator is proportional to that. That is in textbook if you want, like Scully does it. It would take like, I don't think it's worth it for what we want to do. But yes, it's, you just can prove that under the condition that divergence is zero, they commute. So the Coulomb gauge is just convenient. So people just kept the P times A Hamiltonian. And then people did calculations with that. Okay, and that is the, so the conclusion of this. Conclusion of this is the interaction Hamiltonian is just equal to something like E to EM P hat dot A E. Of course, they fixed the gauge. Now, problems. People started computing and realized if I pick a different gauge, I get different physics. Now, people tried to do it in different gauges, and they didn't predict the same results. Second, I need to do to throw out the A squared terms. And in fact, you see, the problem is that your coupling is so gauge dependent, written like this, that it's difficult, or it was difficult for the first attempts to do this, to believe that actually this is a meaningful way of coupling. We know physics should be gauge independent, so what's going on? Now, the first solution to this came from Mary Goeppermayer, Nobel Prize in Physics, for the nuclear shell model. So, let me just check the spelling, because I always. All right. Multiple expansion. Plus dipole approximation. So what Mary Goeppermayer did is like, well, this kind of interaction, I can actually expand in multiples. I can get a basis of solutions to the electromagnetic field and a basis of solutions to the atom parts, the free part, and expand them in spherical harmonics and do a multiple expansion in those. And then I can do an approximation where I keep the first multiple, the dipole. Now, interesting enough, doing that, Mary Goeppermayer could recast a Hamiltonian like this as explicitly gauge independent. So instead of being functions of A and U, they were functions of E and B. Okay? So this is the same as write Hi as function of gauge independent variables. Okay, So in particular, E and B.
All right? And the interaction Hamiltonian under the dipole approximation that we will discuss a little bit later was just of this form, E, X of the atom, coupled to E. And I'm not neglecting A squared terms here. I'm doing the whole Hamiltonian, including the A squared. Or Mary Goppermayer was doing the full Hamiltonian, okay? No neglection of funny second order terms in there. All right? Yes, there's a multiple expansion and only the dipole is picked. But that's the only approximation made. You could go further away and consider magnetic dipoles and electric quadruples and so on and so forth. Still will be functions of B and E. All right. Good. Now, people started computing with this Hamiltonian. People call that in quantum optics the D times E Hamiltonian versus the P times A Hamiltonian. People started computing transition probabilities and well, all the physics of particles, of atoms, I guess, coupled to the field. And they realized that if you compute with a P times A, which comes, remember, from throwing this out and picking the Coulomb gauge, and the Mary Goppermayer result, they got different results. They predicted different physics. So this is pointing out things that are being done wrong, okay? So what do you think is the reason, or do you have any clue as to what the reason was why they gave different results? Where could it come from? So the people who realized of this, that the results were different, people actually started using this one. The reason being that it's way more elegant. It's like, yeah, sure, I don't do any approximations yet. I write everything in terms of explicitly gauge invariant variables. And then I do approximations that I understand. And also reproduce experiments. So we're good with this. But this one, why doesn't this one work? The people who actually make them work were, or explain why it didn't work and said how to do it right to an extent, is the lamb shift person, Scully, and someone else that I don't remember by heart. Slicher, I don't know how to pronounce it. Right? And it's slightly subtle, which is like when you are solving, wow, can you still read this? Schrödinger equation for the atom. You picked a gauge. Now, the wave functions that you find in textbooks, I mean, you know that Schrödinger equation, if I write it with this Hamiltonian, the equation is not gauge invariant if I am not transforming as well the wave function of the atom. Have you ever seen that? That is kind of the way people, without getting into a lot of fundamental physics, the way people justify this minimal coupling. That's a justification often used for the minimal coupling. What is, I know how gauge transformations would affect the wave function. What would be the coupling that cancels that so the equation has the same form? I'm not taking that path, but it's easy to see that if you write a Schrödinger equation with this Hamiltonian, you're required to transform the wave functions too. If you do a gauge transformation, in order for the equation to be gauge invariant, okay, which is a minimal requirement for any dynamic equation. Now, the problem is that the textbook solutions are picked in a gauge, or are solved explicitly without saying in a gauge that there's no A. In a gauge that there's no A, is not the same as the Coulomb gauge. So people were using use of
maybe the problem was a gauge mismatch between atomic wave functions and the Coulomb gauge. All right. So that was understood in the, I'll tell you exactly what year. That was understood in the late 80s. So people knew these things in field theory, but in quantum optics, those things weren't discussed at all. I mean, people were doing the right thing. They were taking the Gopper measure, proposed Hamiltonian, but they didn't realize why they, or at least the community, this was a paper that was an important paper of 87. And people realized of these things in the late 80s, okay, and that people were actually doing it. People kind of abandoned the P times A, but they were still in textbooks, I know. Hmm? All right, so fair enough. So two Hamiltonians, there's a gauge issue. Now, if you actually do the right gauge transformation, if you actually transform your wave function from the, let's call it the Schrödinger gauge, and the reason I call it that is because it's not really an exact gauge unless you do some approximations. But anyway, the gauge in which actually you solve the Schrödinger equation and the Coulomb gauge, once you do the right transformation of the wave functions, you get a complete match between the two predictions. The dipole model prediction and the P times A prediction. There's an approximation in the way that makes the dipole model work as the, only a dipole without considering higher moments, higher quadrupoles and so on. But basically that was resolved. Question so far. This is just an historical introduction, so don't worry too much about the details. All right. It seems kind of obvious a posteriori, but trust me, it took many years. It took more than 20 years for people to figure out what was going on there. All right. So now, what we want now, so this is just a little bit of a story about the light-matter interaction. To actually justify from first principles a Hamiltonian that makes sense in the light-matter interaction. Now we go back to quantum field theory and say, right, you were talking about measuring quantum fields and you ended up talking about this instead. Why? Well, the reason is, what do you think is a good particle detector? And this is a historic name, right? A particle detector is something that you plug into the field. Okay. Can anyone give me a suggestion for a definition of particle detector? I mean, common sense. I don't really want exact solutions or anything. What do you want from a particle detector? Let's see.
Count particles.
Count particles. Yeah, right? So what's a particle? That's the problem. So if we actually go rigorous, what's a particle? Non-trivial, huh? So, okay, a particle detector is something that measures the field. So we want it, first of all, do we want it to be localized? What do you think? Do you want to carry it? Do you want to be able to move it, to put it in some place you want? You want to do a measurement of the field in a region? So it's a localized in time and space. Right? Quantum system. So something that you couple, localize in time and space, to a quantum field. So we want to couple to a quantum field. Easy to measure. Itself, we talked a little bit about it's difficult to measure quantum fields. It is not difficult to measure atoms. Implementing projective measurements on atoms as a good approximation to what you do to an atom is something that people do in their labs all the time. And people have control on the errors that you make when you actually do projective measurements on atoms. So that is fine. Easy to measure. This is your quality, the clicking quality. Something that goes click when
detects a particle. So if it starts in the ground state and gets excited to an excited state, you should be able to realize that. Okay? The way people usually do it in the lab is like, well, it gets excited and then de-excites, and I can measure the excitation. Sometimes differently, but that's one way to do it. Okay? Right, what else? Ah, that implies non-relativistic in the sense of first quantized. Because if it were a relativistic field, then we have a problem because, again, we don't know how to measure those. So we want all those qualities from a particle detector. And it seems to me that the hydrogen atom could be a good model for a particle detector. Right? In fact, particle detectors that you use in labs, CCD cameras and all, are based on piling up a lot of atoms, and those atoms interact with the quantum field. The typical, the avalanche detectors is like a magnified hydrogen atom. So a hydrogen atom seems to be a good candidate for a particle detector. That's what I'm arguing here. So can we at the university, we would kill for this. Like, it's amazing. You don't have to raise anything. So good. You don't know how lucky you are. Well, I guess you do. Anyway, so. All right. So we've kind of agreed, or I hope that we agreed. If not, please tell me, that a hydrogen atom is kind of a good model for a particle detector. And we kind of know how the hydrogen atom couples to the electromagnetic field, right? So let's delve a little bit into that. From dipole coupling. So I know that some of you may be thinking, where's all this juicy fundamental physics that Eduardo promised to talk about? We need this in order to get there. So bear with me. If you're not really motivated by the light matter interaction in itself, it motivates me though. But if it's not really motivating to you, just wait, because we need this. Otherwise, it would be all about, and I wave my hands and there's a photon here, whatever that means. So let's just not accept offhand that we can go to the advanced. Let's do that approach at this bottom to top. Let's not just jump into the advanced stuff without knowing the basics, okay? So let's try to make all the statements rigorous. And to do that, I need to be careful on what I call detection and measurement on a field. So bear with me, okay? From the dipole coupling to the Andrew DeWitt model. So the Andrew DeWitt model is something that generalizes that thing that we wrote up there. And it's not going to be made up. It's going to come from first principles. It's not going to come from, like, let's think what is reasonable for a coupling. And let's write it as in photon emitted, photon absorbed, energy conservation, quote, quote, energy conservation arguments and stuff like that. No, let's just go from first principles. Actually, Mary Goeppermayer knew what she was doing. So let's just, take that kind of coupling and see what it leads us if we actually want to do quantum optics. Okay? All righty. So starting from the interaction Hamiltonian, I'm not going to quantize the field until the end. At the end, I will introduce canonical quantization on the field. But for now, let's start from there. All right, so I want something that looks like this in terms of, like, I want, like, have a control in terms of a basis of solutions and atomic orbitals and stuff like that. So how do I do this? All right, so first step, let's introduce. Let's write this operator as in terms of its matrix elements. So I have E sum over I sum over J, and I'm going to put J here. All
So these are atomic states, of course, because the field is not quantized yet. So. And this multiplies. Let me just write it in the interaction picture. So in the interaction picture, I would have I omega ij t, where omega ij is the energy level between I, the energy difference between I and j. And this, of course, goes with the matrix elements ji. I don't like that one, but whatever. That's what I wrote. All right, this is nothing. This is just expanded in terms of explicitly his matrix elements. Everyone happy with that? Okay. So the next step, let's introduce the identity in there. And the identity I can have, because I have the spectrum of the X operator, the spectrum of the X operator understood as a self-adjoint extension of the X operator, actually generates a complete basis for states of the atom. So let's just expand. Let's introduce the identities, spectral decompositions of the identity here. So I, j, dx, three dimensions, let's say. I mean, we're going to work in arbitrary dimensions. But we're doing a hydrogen kind of atom, so makes sense, no? So let me just introduce here j, x, x. E of x. Of course, E depends on time as well. I'm not writing that explicitly because the notation is already long. But keep in mind that this is a full electromagnetic field. It could depend on time as well. OK, it satisfies Maxwell equations. All right, x prime, and I have here I, and I have e to the I omega I j t, and I have j I. All right. Yeah.
Where does the e to I omega I j t?
Say again?
Where does the e to the I omega I j t come
from? I'm doing these operators in the interaction picture. That's why. It's convenient to have it explicitly there. That's why. It would be the free evolution of the X operator on the two states that you have, evaluated on the two states that you have. So, but what I did, again, maybe let me write interaction picture. I'm going to write a little d here, or big D, I guess. This is the notation for interaction picture, Dirac picture, OK? And what it is that I included, well, I redefined, I made a unitary map of the operators that I have here to U not operator, U not dagger, which is kind of including the free evolution into the operators. OK? And this is the time dependence of it, because everything I wrote, I rewrote in terms of writing the usual interaction picture formalism. All right, questions? Pretty straightforward so far. Now, these things I can identify, right? Those are the wave functions. It's an atom, so I know I can use the textbook wave functions because they work well with a gauge-independent Hamiltonian. Those are the ones that you have to use. So what you get is psi x prime of the level I. And I have here psi of x of the level j. All right. And then I also know, for example, if so these two things, this is an eigenstate of this. So that is just an x not operator but variable. And this is an e evaluated on the variable, not operator anymore. And then I get here x, x prime. And x, x prime is, can I do a little bit? And this is a delta 3 of x. This is all vectors, of course, that I'm forgetting all the time, minus x prime. OK. Now, with that delta, we can do one of the integrals. And what we get. This is such a luxury. I love these boards. OK. Sum over I, sum over j, one integral. Didn't I write the prime here? I didn't, right? D3x. And then I get psi j of x x psi I of x,
and then
that dots E of x,
I have this thing,
e to the I omega ij t,
and I got
ji.
All right. So, actually, this sum is a little bit of an overkill, because we know that for atoms, some of these elements are zero. In particular, so the way to see it, this thing, there's parity considerations here. So this thing has the parity, so the wave functions have defined parity, as you know, depending what orbital you're in. Then x has defined parity as well. It's odd, it's a vector. And this thing, if you expand E in a complete set of solutions of Maxwell equations, of well, the wave equation that comes from Maxwell equations, you know that this thing is going to be proportional to E to the I kind of kx. This thing, we know, can be decomposed in terms of term of some parity here and here. So you can expand it in spherical harmonics. And then with those considerations, I can give you the reference where those considerations are computed. The problem with that is like it's several, many pages of dealing with boring 3J symbols. But what I want to tell you is that most, or many, when you have infinite, what does it mean most? Huh? Many of these matrix elements are zero. For instance, I equals j. So I, sorry, yeah. If I equals j, then so I guess there's no I to I transition. If I is equal to j, those elements are zero. The diagonal elements of that operator are zero. Also, there's selection rules. You may have heard about. Have you heard about selection rules in atomic physics before? That had to do with the parity of this expression, of the integrand of this, when it cancels and when it doesn't. Basically, you need orbitals that have a difference of angular momentum of 0 plus minus 1. If you go to higher multiples, you can get more than that. But for the dipole approximation, that's what you get out of the parity of this. Also, transitions from L equals 0 to L equals 0 are forbidden. That kind of thing. So most of these elements are 0. I don't care too much about these elements, the ones I know. So I could write, I for sure can write this sum as a sum I different from J, just getting rid of the diagonal elements. But let's simplify this. Because in atomic physics, usually, we can only monitor. All right. In atomic physics, we can only monitor a few levels. Let's assume that we're going to work only with two levels of the hydrogen atom. OK? Let's say that only two levels are going to be involved in my dynamics. I have some device that prevents the other levels from getting excited. These selection rules do a lot of that for you, except for spin degeneracy and angular momentum degeneracy. So, but you can think of a transition S2P or something like that, and only monitoring one of the P orbitals, something like this if you want. Or to a state that includes the three of them in a particular basis, not counting degeneracy. So, if we simplify this model to two levels, things get super easy, and I really want to get this Hamiltonian before finishing this. The sum is a sum on two elements each, so and there's no diagonal elements, so what we get is the integral on, oh, by the way, the one thing that I've been forgetting all the time is the coupling strength. Integral dx, and let me write some f vector of x e to the I omega. That's gonna go with, let's say this goes with the excitation. Sigma plus F conjugate of X e to the minus I omega T sigma minus. What is this? Sigma plus is just, again, it takes the ground and returns the excited. So it's this. All right? SU2 ladder operator. This one takes the excited and returns the ground. Okay? Okay, only two levels I'm doing. That thing couples to the electric field. And I hope I don't forget anything. And then this F of X, let's call it mirroring vector, is just the product of the way I defined it. It's excited here, all right? So it's excited X ground conjugate, the wave function of the excited and the ground state. And then I can write this as the integral of dx dipole operator of x coupled to e of x, where the dipole operator is this thing. Maybe I'll write it here because of time. This thing is the dipole operator of x. All right. And then we have a Hamiltonian like this. And what we can do, so keep this form, you see, you get in here sigma plus and sigma minus, kind of similar to sigma plus and sigma minus showing up there. Now this dipole operator, this Hamiltonian now, what we can do is we can quantize the electromagnetic field, so canonical quantization of E becomes E of X. Quantize electromagnetic field, canonical quantization. We know how to do that. Quantize in the free field, that's in all textbooks, even the bad ones. And then, just a reflection before finishing, like one quick reflection. Can I do that? Okay. So if I write, I don't want to forget any factors. If I expand the electric field in terms of plane wave solutions, you know, that's how you do canonical quantization. Write a general solution to this in terms of a basis, and then the amplitudes of that general solution, let's add there the structure of commutation there, so they become, the amplitudes become the A's and A daggers. You've seen, I'm assuming you've seen all that before. And if we write E in terms, let me just write the T explicitly now, in terms of plane wave solutions, I get sum over polarizations of integral D3K square root of, because I'm in three dimensions, all right, square root of modulus k divided by 2. And then I get minus I a ks polarization vector ks e to the I, if you want, k mu x mu, just to write it fast, plus its Hermitian conjugate. Okay, maybe I should write the Hermitian conjugate for the point I want to make. Huh? So that would be plus a dagger, I a dagger, ks. E to the minus I. Now, look at this interesting thing here. Of course, the electric field is an expansion of an infinite number of modes of frequency k or wave vector k. And here, I do have sigma plus and sigma minus multiplying A and A dagger, right? What I'm doing here is not really funny. The dipole operator of the electron couples an observable of the atom couples to an observable of the field. It's not a very strange coupling, isn't it? It's just an observable to observable kind of coupling. Also, inspired by classical physics, this is classical. That's the way dipoles couple to fields. Now, oh, the dipole operator usually includes the E. Okay, sorry about that. Now, interesting. If you actually compare this model, that's what we're going to start doing, with this, what is missing? What's the most important difference? Do you see it? You get, so here you get schematically sigma plus sigma minus times A plus A dagger, no? That gives those terms and some more. Where are the terms of the form? Sigma plus A dagger. Where are the terms of the form? Sigma minus A. What do those terms do if we apply the logic that we were talking about before? Well, those terms seem to be exciting the atom by emitting a photon and the exciting the atom by capturing a photon. Those terms are not magic. Those terms come from the most naive of couplings, the dipole coupling. Everyone with me in this? You cannot just cross them out. If you want to cross them out, you may need a reason. So you cannot cross them out. How do people cross them out? And that's what we will start discussing in the next lecture. In quantum optics, often you will hear, I mean, people who knows know quantum optics, but I mean, it's often in, even in textbooks, I've seen it. Yeah, but those terms don't conserve energy in a similar way to if the frequencies are not the same, meaning that, what does that mean, a process where I have zero photons and an excited atom, and then suddenly I get a photon and an excited atom? The problem with that is that people tend to think of photons like if they were particles. That's a problem, as if they were creating a ball out of nothing and then throwing the ball. So the question I want to leave you with today, and we will answer it tomorrow, is like, why? I mean, there are terms like this, for sure. You cannot get rid of them. They make sense. They make sense. They come from first principles, all right? And in the model people use, they don't consider them. Why is that? We're going to understand that and discuss this in the next lecture, as well as introduce the Andrew-Witt model and show how something like this, that seems a little bit simple, still first principles, but simple, and consider atoms that are systems that are non-relativistic. Remember, particle detectors, non-relativistic. The model of particle detection is actually fully covariant. And we will see that. OK? All right, then. I'll see you tomorrow. I left you enough to think about it.